Welcome to Chewing the Yacht, WAMF 90.3 FM. Chewing the Yacht, we talk to some of New Orleans' most interesting people. And today we talk to investigative reporter Michael Perlstein, or Mike, perhaps I will call him, as we've been friends for a while. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us here.
Of course. Happy to have you invite me. And Michael was the newspaper byline. That was 20 years at the Times-Picayune. And Mike was the TV sig out for WWL-TV for 16 years.
All right. Well, Mike is a Pulitzer Prize winner and an Emmy winner as well. So
Don't forget that Morrow.
Oh, and Edward O. Morrow Award. And a lot of other awards as well. I mean,
You do journalism long enough, and journalism groups are very big on, you know, awarding each other.
Right. Well, I started my own group so I can give myself an award.
There you go.
So just don't tell anybody. Well, let's see. You had a really full career in journalism. In New Orleans, we know you from the Times-Picayune, and several people know you from your teaching jobs at Loyola and other universities as well, I think.
Well, let's see. SUNO, Dillard, Tulane. Right. And then Loyola full-time for 4 years.
Okay, all right. And then, of course, in the last 15 years, you've been the investigator, reporter, or give or take, because I think you were a producer at first when you went to WWL.
I was managing editor of investigations was the title.
Well, maybe we'll explain that at some point. But So you grew up in California?
Well, actually, I was son of an Air Force captain. So being a military brat, I lived all over the country.
Okay.
Born in Alabama.
Yeah.
Stops in everywhere from California, Ohio, Oregon, Arkansas, D.C., Virginia, Arizona. But born in Montgomery, Alabama. Too many people would guess that. And I was only there for 9 months.
Right.
But
right.
It's on my birth certificate.
Yeah, I know the feeling. I'm kind of associated with New Orleans, and unfortunately I was born someplace else.
Oh, yeah. You're Mr. New Orleans, really? You're born somewhere else?
My father played for the Los Angeles Rams.
There you go.
So I was born in Los Angeles. And then like a week or two later, the season was over, we came back. So I just missed it by a week or two.
Right.
But still.
Now, I will add, I've lived in New Orleans much longer than I have any other place. Close to 40 years now.
Wow.
And then, you know, some formative years when my dad got out of the Air Force were Southern California, you know, Riverside outside of L.A.
Is that where you went to high school?
So I went to junior high and high school in the L.A. area.
Well, that's pretty formative, though, those years.
They are.
You know, that's kind of how I kind of define Orleanians. You know, if they went to high school here, that's okay. But
I learned that right away when people ask you what school did you go to.
Yeah.
They don't mean your college.
Right.
Or your grad school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They mean your high school.
Right.
If you can't name a local one, you're not a native.
Yeah. Well, we're growing up, as you did, all over the place. I mean, that's kind of a pretty decent background for being a journalist, because you get kind of a perspective of different places of the world, of the country.
You know, I mean, somewhat. I certainly got the, you know, trait of adaptability, because a lot of those moves were in the middle of a school year,
right.
Somewhat disruptive. I did get to know different parts of the country, but I would say that the core traits of a journalist, you're kind of born with it.
Okay. Well,
natural curiosity.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who, when there's a do not enter sign, of course you want to enter. Off limits, you figure out a way to get in.
Yeah, yeah.
This is secret, let me find out.
That's
the natural core trait, at least for what I did most of my career, which was investigative journalism.
All right. Well, you went to Reed College, and I just want to talk about that briefly. It's kind of an unusual place. It has a forest and canyon nature reserve in the middle of it.
They do have a canyon, yes.
And I see that Gary Schneider, the poet, went there, and I, as a poet myself, I have to say this for myself. He's one of my least favorite poets of all time. I don't have any much regard for him as a poet. I need to say that for my own.
Well, he made his mark some way.
He did.
Now, there was a little counterculture streak, associated with Reed being in the Great Northwest. But I will say that I'm in pretty good company among the illustrious alumni. are people like Dr. Demento.
Right, Dr. Demento. I was going to mention that. Dr. Demento.
We have our legendary dropout,
Steve Jobs. Yeah.
And I'll tell you a quick, you know, anecdote about Steve Jobs and Reed. Obviously, he whizzed through any class he took because he was a very smart guy. He dropped out to, I guess, invent a computer that he became Apple computer.
Yeah,
I think
he did
pretty well with that. But that year after he dropped out, he stayed at Reed and he audited classes and just dropped in and you know, cherry picked what he wanted to learn and know as he was learning all about, you know, Buddhism, among other things. But one of those things was calligraphy. Calligraphy is a just revered art form at Reed for whatever reason. I don't know the origins, but Steve Jobs became master at calligraphy. And that became the inspiration for the drop-down menu of all the fonts that you see on every computer.
Okay.
Even in the early primitive computer, the Macintosh.
Yeah, sure.
He made sure to incorporate a drop-down menu of fonts based on his love of calligraphy.
Well, that's an interesting anecdote for sure. Well, you know...
Look, if we're talking about Reed, I've got to tell you another story I love to tell about Reed. Is that I often tell people I went to college with the Simpsons.
Okay.
The Simpsons, with the actual Simpsons, the cartoon. I know people say, come on, man, what's the, you know, punchline? But it's kind of true because for anyone who knows, you know, Simpsons, all of that is based on Matt Groening's actual family.
Okay.
He grew up in Washington, just over the border with Oregon, very close to Portland. And I was in my freshman dorm with Maggie, his sister.
Okay.
And Matt would come and hang out at the Reed. He was a little older than me. He would hang out at the Reed College coffee shop. Bumming around, I guess. He would scribble and doodle.
Right.
Nobody knew what the heck he was doing. He had a cartoon, I guess, that was the origins of
Life in Hell,
which appeared in alternative magazines all over the country, and eventually catapulted into the, you know, the Simpsons. And in addition to Maggie, who was very true to her character on TV, I don't think I ever heard her speak.
Really?
I was in a dorm with her for an entire year. So she was really the one who didn't speak much. I guess there was another sister. I don't know where she was or went. Lisa, Brainy, and, you know, Bart, based on Matt himself.
So, well, that's pretty interesting. That is interesting. You know, well, I guess now that you mention it, I mean, the Simpsons does kind of have a Portland-y vibe to a certain extent.
Certainly Northwest. I mean, Springfield, I think, is, you know, meant to be a little more, you know, middle of the country, but his sensibilities were, how would you describe the Northwest, sort of like the Portlandia vibe of grassrootsy but eccentric at the same time?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I had a girlfriend up there for a while, so I went up there quite a bit, and I like it up there. It's interesting, you know. I have a feature on my other radio show that I do. It's called The Great Pacific Northwest. I've kind of changed it because I changed the name to something else, but I remember I was doing things about the news from New Orleans on my show, which I do, and Wait, Don't Shoot Me, which is a thing that I do. And so I decided, I was reading the Oregonian, so I kind of look at different papers, and the headline in New Orleans is probably people getting murdered, and the big headline on the Oregonian was somebody killed a seagull. So I decided that, you know, there's something different going on up there.
Well, the big headline for me as a college student is no rain yesterday, because it would...
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes rain, it seemed like it was every single day of the entire school year. Now, the summers are spectacular, but during school year, a lot of the students, like myself, didn't stick around for the good part.
Well, I found that when I was there, the rain would come often, like you said, but it wasn't like it would stop.
No. Never heavy. And in my 4 years, I never owned an umbrella.
There you go.
Every lawn was like perfect because of a very light, drizzly rain almost every day.
Yeah. I mean, the last time I was in Seattle, when we were walking downtown, it rained a lot. It would rain for like 5 minutes. And you didn't need a rain an umbrella, you know?
Portland, Seattle are similar. But yeah, you end up spending a lot of time in the library.
Yeah. And one last thing about Reed, unless you have something else that you want to say. It's the only college in the United States that has a nuclear reactor that's run by students.
That's correct.
So maybe I should go there. I need a nuclear
weapon. True story. If you want to be a nuclear physicist, that's the place.
Yeah. And then you went to Northwestern. Now, you were a math major at Reed.
That's
right.
Math major, which simply meant I got too far into math to change my major to some of the things that I love math, don't get me wrong. It's just that once you get into some higher level math, turns out it's like difficult. It gets really hard.
Yeah, sure.
And I was okay, but I'm around these, you know, math prodigies, and I quickly realized, okay, won't be doing this for a living. But no, I was taking writing and, you know, like writing little satirical things for the newspaper, and, you know, really started to get into, you know, deeper levels of writing. I was a tutor at the writing lab, and it was just basically too late to change my major, but put heavy emphasis on, you know, my English and my writing. And I just sat back and I thought, okay, how can I make a living writing? And the options are, you know, run across the spectrum. You could certainly do things like, you know, write the next great American novel and sit around with that in the bottom drawer of your, you know, of your desk and starve, you know, be a starving artist with great, great respect for that route. But I had student loans to pay off, so I went ahead and thought, journalism. I've always been the curious kid. I've always been the one that, you know, when it says off limits, you know, I would find a way to sneak in. So, sight unseen, I researched the J schools, the journalism graduate programs. And, you know, the big three are considered Columbia, and Missouri, and Northwestern, right. You know, up in Evanston and Chicago. The big draw for Northwestern was it was the most practical, hands-on, professional program. And it only, you could actually complete it in a year. Columbia, I think, was 2 years. Yeah. And the way I was figuring it was, I just went through four pretty grinding years of heavy liberal arts, you know, at Reed, and I got my education for the most part. Let me learn a profession, and Northwestern allowed me to do that. Hit the ground running. I spent a semester in Washington D.C. writing for the Medill News Service. My beat and newspaper was the Rapid City Journal in South Dakota. Generated quite a few bylines for that paper, and it was glorious to me. I was the only Washington correspondent for all of South Dakota.
Wow.
And as a result, had pretty wide access to being a very sparsely populated state. Two senators, of course, like every state, but only one representative.
Right.
And that one rep was Tom Daschle. He was quite powerful, influential, and he made, you know, I guess, toyed with running for president. And so I had access to a guy who was in the news quite a bit just by being the South Dakota correspondent.
Was Everest a senator then?
He had just wrapped up.
Okay.
We had Pressler, Larry Pressler.
Sure, I remember him.
Was another one.
The reason I ask is a friend of mine is that's her uncle, James Everest.
There you go.
Yeah.
But anyway, so
I remember him also.
Just walking the corridors of power in D.C., it once again, you know, just kind of sharpened my desire to, this is fun and interesting, and every day is different, and it's unpredictable. And now, mind you, just before that, I'll kind of tell you the story of what got me to New Orleans, which was I was in a program with a lot of people who actually had substantial journalism experience. Some were already at newspapers, magazines. You know, they wanted to get a master's degree just to enhance their career or, you know, take a step up. Others were coming maybe from PR or some other communications into journalism. I was a math major. I had nothing. So, except I did love to write, and I was a curious kid. So, I realized that I probably should get my foot in the door, get a little experience, generate some bylines. And I applied to maybe, I think the number was like 15, 18 different internships that had been, you know, posted at Northwestern. Small, medium, couple metropolitan papers, one of them being the Times-Picayune. And then one by one, I got, there was no email back then, it was a long time ago, I got rejection letters from paper after paper, and some were handwritten, keep in touch, some were form letters. The one that I didn't even hear back from was the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. That was one of the largest papers I applied to, just for a summer internship. But, you know, just to be methodical about it, wanted to cross them off the list, you know, once and for all. So I called, and I got Jim Amos on the phone, the Metro editor at the time. And he said, yes, very interesting resume, but you didn't send any clips. So I had to be honest with him, and I said, well, I don't have any clips. I'm just starting up here at, you know, Medill, the J school. But then I followed up the honesty with a lie, I said. But I have some really great writing samples. I did not have any writing samples. However, I was in a class, I had just started a class, which was like a mock newsroom, and I was given a beat of Arlington Heights, a suburb of Chicago, and I knew that in the next couple of weeks, I was going to be generating a lot of stories, assignments, on a daily basis, edited by my professor, getting some expert editing. So I told the little white lie that I was going to have a bunch of writing samples to send him. And so, sure, send them along. So I really worked, it was as if I needed extra incentive. So I worked pretty hard in that class, and there was legit news going on. Arlington Heights, somehow, right when I was doing this, was the first municipality to pass its own gun control ordinance.
Okay.
It had been done and tried by, you know, states and other places, but this was the first, like, municipality, this tiny little suburb of Chicago. So I'm there with the Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Tribune, and some national media, and I'm just writing it for class, but I'm also thinking, okay, this is a big national story that maybe they've heard of down in New Orleans.
Sure.
And I did a big couple big takeouts on that issue, going to their council meetings. And then I had this bright idea, this bright, naive idea, as a, you know, budding prospective journalist, because I hadn't seen in any of the major newspaper accounts the mayor weighing in on this. Where's the mayor? So the naive part is, let me get out the white pages, look for George T. Ryan, the mayor, George, middle initial T, Ryan. There he is in the white pages. Man, this journalism thing is easy. So I just call him up. I get him on the phone talking about, you know, after some pleasantries, the issue, and just wondering, you know, what's his official stand and statement. He did have some opinions. When I talked about his interaction, you know, with counsel, he goes, whoa, wait a minute. You think I'm George T. Ryan, the mayor? I'm just a guy who has the exact same name as the mayor, and I get these calls all the time. People thinking I'm the mayor. And I said, that's hilarious. Tell me, what do the people have to say? Who are all these people calling you? And he had just a great, you know, anecdotes of people cursing him out, people like praising something he did, you know, people lobbying for some issue. And I just took those down, especially the really hilarious ones, the angry callers trying to beat up on the mayor. And I turned that into a, I don't know, we would call it a human interest feature.
Okay.
But I was able to, you know, yeah, show absolutely a writing flair and be kind of humorous about it.
Sure.
And I sent that along, and I think that got me over the top. And Jim Amos, in fact, gave me a call. Well, actually, he didn't give me a call. I called him after I set off my writing samples, my assignments. And he said, Yeah, so I'm glad you called. We were going to call you. We would like you to come down for the summer.
Oh, well, great.
Yeah. And that was the rest is history.
Wow, yeah. And it's interesting. It's always interesting to talk to people who have been successful like yourself and how they kind of got started and different things like that. These are interesting stories. Not really.
Count my lucky stars on that.
Yeah. And
I will say that at the time, I was also fortunate that Jim Amos, who was doing the hiring, he was taking the time speaking it, I guess, to another level of national impact and some high-level professionalism, being, you know, thinking ambitiously, and broke out of, I guess, the previous model of hiring, you know, local kids or LSU, you know, Banship School grads.
Yeah.
In fact, there was a running joke at the time I was getting hired that, you know, Jim Amos, Ivy League guy that he is, really preferred Ivy League, you know, graduates. I wasn't Ivy League. I was the Ivy alternative way out in Reed in Portland. But I did benefit from what we would call, say, you know, an enlightened editor who actually welcomed people from, you know, different backgrounds, unusual resumes, and math major to writing, I guess,
sure,
fit the expansive and enlightened view, and that helped me get that internship, just the summer internship, mind you. But I knew... And I know that the one time I really actually physically danced for joy, got up, put the phone down from that call with Jim Amos and danced around that little room I was renting.
Yeah.
Because I knew foot in the door was all I needed. I was in. I was in the club. And
that's a great story.
Then the rest is actually history.
Yeah. Well, you know, just since we have plenty of time here, I was in graduate school, and the track that I was on was to be a journalist and write about urban affairs. And I talked to some people who I knew who, you know, were connected, and they told me not to waste my time because they wouldn't hire me because I was local,
mm-hmm,
at that time, same time. So anyway, if you don't mind, I was thinking about a story you told me about Ronnie Burgess.
Mm.
At his funeral,
mm-hmm,
it was a story about somebody from the Poynter Institute coming. Would you mind?
Oh, sure. Well, another thing that during that era of the paper when I was there, starting in, you know, 86 all the way through Katrina, was a, you know, relationship that had been cultivated with the Poynter Institute and, you know, it's kind of a certain writerly approach, you know, kind of breaking past the inverted pyramid style. And, you know, we had some tremendous talent at that paper, some real, you know, wordsmiths already. But occasionally we would get somebody from the Poynter Institute to come and give a little talk. And the head guy there was named Roy Peter Clark, and he was giving the big seminar on just kind of the latest cutting edge and, you know, writing and, you know, human narrative above the basic who, what, when, where, why. And he held up a front page of the paper to basically say that here are multiple stories on your front page that fit the formula. They don't jump off the page. They might be a cure for insomnia, written in the, you know, the standard newspaper style. But he pointed to another story that had a lively anecdotal lead and was obviously artfully written, and the byline was Ronnie Burgess. Twist there was that Ronnie Burgess was not a staff writer. He was a freelancer. He had been trying to get, you know, hired by the paper. He was a bit of a, you know, kind of a rapscallion personality. So I think they might have been a little hesitant to, you know, bring Ronnie on board. But he's a brilliant writer. And as we all know, kind of the Renaissanceat. But that was pointed out in a room full of the entire writing staff of the paper, that the one story singled out by Roy Peter Clark is like brilliant writing, fitting the new model of journalism, with someone who the paper had been reluctant to hire. That got rectified, and sure enough, Ronnie Burgess did get hired. He ended up having a column, very popular and widely read. And Ronnie Burgess being Ronnie Burgess, he would absolutely want me to tell the whole story, was he got fired in that crazy, he got hired in that crazy way, and he also got fired later on.
Yeah.
In another crazy way, but it's a different story.
Right. Well, thank you for relaying that too. I appreciate that. We're going to get to WWL in a minute, but when you went to Times Picayune, I mean, your beat was crime, the police department, the courts, right?
Well, not initially. Like all hires at the paper, had to pay my dues, and that meant going to one of the suburban bureaus. And the paper had a very strong monopoly. Bureaus in, you know, East and West Bank of Jefferson Parish, a couple of different locations in St. Tammany, Baton Rouge, obviously, they even had a D.C. bureau. And the river parishes in Laplace, as well as St. Bernard / Plaquemines in Chalmette. I got hired to be the, I guess, beat writer for Plaquemines Parish. So based in Chalmette, Plaquemines didn't even have its own office or bureau. I reported to Chalmette. I made that drive down to Pointe de la Hache, east bank of Plaquemines Parish, about an hour one way, multiple times a month, and that's how I cut my teeth, you know, at the newspaper. And I will have one funny story if we're going into humorous anecdotes. When I finished graduate school and I drove cross country in that 71 Buick Skylark, and I was not going to jump in immediately to the job search, just wanted to, you know, decompress after finishing my degree, and I was in Vegas. I was at the Circus Casino, as a matter of fact, gambling a little bit. And my mom tracked me down. She knew that where I was staying, and I got a message, you know, call your mom. So I called her from the payphone in that lobby of the Circus Casino. She said, this guy named Jim Amos called, he wants you to call him right away. And I did. I called Jim. And so right there at the payphone in the lobby of the Circus Casino, he offered me the job. And I remember two things very distinctly about that conversation. I don't remember the whole conversation. I guess that was an important call. First, he said, you know, he offered me the job. We, you know, we'd love to have you back. You know, and I'll give you some time to think about it. I said, no, like, you know, I want to come back. You know, I worked with you all summer. I said, I want to come back. So I said yes on the spot. I did not need time to think about it. And then he said, well, we have an opening in covering Plaquemines Parish. It's our best suburban beat. Our best suburban beat. That turned out to be, let's just say, a subjective opinion of Plaquemines. It's the most remote, maybe the least populated, the furthest drive for sure. I don't know about best, but to me, it was one of the great beats. For me, not from Louisiana, I'm out there kind of deep in the little boot that sticks out into the Gulf of Mexico, and it was crazy, wild, exotic.
Sure.
There were, you know, crusty oyster fishermen, you know, deep history of corruption, wild and woolly politics, and I thought it was amazing. Mm-hmm. Once again, from an outsider perspective,
sure,
it was really exotic.
Yeah, but
and I'm up in air helicopters and going to see the sulfur mines of, you know, the Freeport background. So I loved it, and you know, I was actually able to take little Plaquemines and develop big front page stories. And I knew that, I admit it, I was shirking my duties as a beat reporter writing for the little Metro Zone edition. No, I did what I had to do. But I had my eyes why not? I'm just young and, you know, borderline reckless. Shoot for the front page, shoot for the Sunday, you know, which I had kind of done as an intern when I didn't have a beat and no, you know, everything I did was Lanyap, you know, as an intern. So I latched on to things like the all-out war between Vietnamese immigrant fishermen, shrimpers,
right,
who were just hustling and putting a little pressure on some of the longtime, you know, local native fishermen.
Sure.
And it turned to an all-out war with burning of boats overnight and shots fired.
Yeah.
And I had a field day with the great Plaquemines, you know, fishing wars.
Yeah.
Got that in a national publication, National Seafood, I think was the name of that. So I did not see Plaquemines as some rinky-dink suburban bureau.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure, I mean, I've never spent a lot of time in Plaquemines, but I mean, I've lived here all my life, and I'm sure it was a lot of interesting things.
Well, and also the very first week, I arrived, boy, I had to go to Point Lhasa a lot because there was a big trial. It was the trial of Leander Perez Jr.
Okay, yeah.
Of the famous Leander Perez family.
That was an eye-opener,
right? Exposed for, you know, decade-long fraud in which they stole over $100 million in public money. Taking a percent of the parish oil royalties.
Right.
Never exposed until decades later that they had a little secret interest under Delta Development Corporation. Well, anyway, the brothers, the two sons of Leander Perez were Leander Perez Jr. and Shallon Perez. Bitter feud. One was, let's see, Leander was the district attorney for a long time, and Shallon was the parish president, and they were subpoenaing and suing each other and bringing charges against each other. I get the very tail end when Leander Jr. is actually on trial for malfeasance related to all this little Shakespearean war between brothers. And boy, was that a history lesson.
Yeah, I bet.
And he was on trial with a judge, with an actual former judge of Plaquemines. They both got acquitted. But what I got to learn the Perez history. I got to learn how to write really fast on tight deadlines, send it over some payphone with a coupler, you know. And one of my first stories got the name of the attorney misspelled. So a lot of lessons in there. But I got that introduction. And I did later cover the last nail in the Perez coffin, which was the settlement of the civil lawsuit, which they had to pay back $80
million. Yeah, and a lot of people got some money from that.
Well, the parish got eventually, you know, made whole. And,
yeah.
Now, the Prezes did just fine.
Sure.
Whatever they walked away with is enough for homes on, you know, you know, Audubon Place in Uptown New Orleans. So they did okay.
Yeah, I'm sure they did, yeah.
And one of my real regrets as a young reporter, Shallon would just call occasionally because he kind of blamed the paper for some of the reporting before I ever got there, exposing the fraud, the lawsuit, when I guess parish officials kind of, there was an anti-Perez movement. Anyway, he was furious about all that, and he would just occasionally call, get me on the phone just to yell and berate me and berate the paper and just profanity-laced tirades on the phone. And it's just part of, you know, the world of Plaquemines. You're going to get the occasional call from Shallon complaining.
Yeah.
But Leander Jr. was very gentlemanly. I actually struck up a, you know, good rapport with him. He was not fire and brimstone. He was just happy to go hunting and fishing and, you know, live a had a peaceful life, and he agreed to sit down and do the first interview of it, you know, any of the existing Perez's. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, first I have to go on this safari in Africa. As soon as I get back, we'll sit down, I'll do the interview. What a coup for a young, you know, reporter.
Sure, yeah.
It was a pretty big deal, you know, locally.
Absolutely.
And he gets back from Africa, he takes sick, And next thing I know, he's on his deathbed. He died. Never got the interview.
Oh, that's too bad.
So that was one of the early regrets. And I think there's a journalistic lesson there, which is don't wait. If someone says, here's information access or interview, like, can we do it today?
Right.
And I will say, I did go to his funeral at the House of Boltman on St. Charles Avenue just to pay my respects, as he and I had, you know, struck up at least a cordial relationship. Paid my respects, only to get kicked out by Shallon, who spotted me there, and it promptly threw me out. So that was my experience.
Oh, my God.
With the Plaquemines beat.
Well, you know, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you. We get to get to some of the more current stuff at WWL. Unless you have something other to say about any of this, you can jump in with, at any time with any story you would
like. You mentioned that, you know, later kind of specialized in criminal justice.
Yeah.
That was a little bit of an offshoot of the work I did in Plaquemines, which was, I saw myself as a big game hunter, I suppose, and wanted to do the bigger, meatier stories. And I had done some considerable digging into criminal justice stories and some you know, injustice claims. And
sure.
I think that's where I got, you know, correctly labeled as a hard news guy as opposed to a feature writer.
Okay.
Knew my way around courts and the law and investigations. So I did get brought to, you know, the main newsroom downtown to, you know, do investigations initially when there was this rampant scandal at City Hall. I don't know if you remember. It was some big investigation and bags of money and this, that, and the other.
Who's mayor?
It was Dutch Moyau.
Okay.
And, you know, he skirted on the edge of, you know, kind of like eyebrow-raising things, never to be tarnished himself by any corruption. But there was just a lot going on, and I was brought in to sniff it out. And you know what happened, really? I sniffed out like nothing. I whiffed.
Yeah.
And I followed the trail, and I heard some, you know, tales of this and that that couldn't be corroborated.
Sure.
But the real story was crime and the police department. So they quickly shifted me over. I did a year on the court, on criminal court. I got to know criminal court quite well. I was kind of a straight police reporter, which initially meant, you know, running out on crime scenes, in addition to the police department as an organization. And doing the police beat, I just did what is stock and trade for good investigative reporters, which is just get to know people. You know, I always preferred, of the two sources you use in investigations, one is the documents and one is the people. And I always preferred the people because the people are more fun than the documents. And the people can point to the stack of documents and say, oh, look at page 67. So the people can bring you the documents. The documents aren't necessarily going to deliver the people.
Sure,
so
they can help you sift through some of that stuff.
I specialized in making contacts with cops all the way down from, you know, just beat cops, platoon officers in the districts, all the way up the chain to high-ranking commanders. And at a time of record-breaking murder rates, highest per capita, you know, murder rate in the entire country, several years running, in rampant police corruption, I started digging my teeth into the corruption.
Well, you know, that's the question. The next question I was going to ask you was about, since you were an investigative reporter at WWL, but also at the Picayune that day, obviously, like you just said, how much pushback do you get generally on stories, you know, when you're doing something like that? I mean, do you get harassment? I mean, I'm sure you must.
Well, that usually comes on the, you know, when the story is in progress, because of course you have to ask all sides of a story, an issue, a finding, an expose, and maybe someone who's being caught with their hand in the cookie jar or cast in a negative light, you got to call them or their attorney or their representative.
Yeah.
What do you have to say about these findings? So all the, you know, pushback comes in the story in progress, and then sometimes you'll see in story after story, you know, this official declined to comment.
Sure.
Well, behind that phrase could mean he, you know, yelled a string of profanities off the record and hung up the phone while saying, "Don't you dare quote me." So
yeah, sure.
Sometimes decline to comment can mean a whole bunch of different things.
Right, right.
But once a story, if you're a good reporter who just follows the basic fairness, balance, accuracy, verify everything, double check, you know, if you use anonymous sources, as little as possible, but make sure the information is all corroborated. If you follow all of that, you come out with what I call unassailable accounts of the facts that can be, you know, proven. And I can, with some pride, say that I have never even been sued, which is the pushback you might get as an investigative reporter, subject of a lawsuit. But like I said, not only were my stories unassailable because it was never personal and I never went after anything or anybody, I followed facts wherever they led.
Right.
And I think the one thing that I tried to cultivate, and sometimes with great success, it really was never personal. And if I was going to cast someone in a negative light, I would actually have some sympathy for the person if they were going to, you know, get arrested, go to prison, lose a job. And I like to call it, it's a little maybe psychological turnaround, that you tell them what you have, you give them the opportunity to comment, you know, you respect them as a human being in a bad situation, and also give them a shoulder to cry on. And I remember one early story of mine was Rudy Schechsneider. I got him kicked out of the police academy. His life's dream was to be a cop. His uncle was a cop. He had all kinds of family in the police department.
Right.
And he had already, what nobody knew or what it got overlooked, he had been in the academy once before and got, you know, kicked out and fired for, like, cashing someone else's check. So some kind of theft by fraud. And his civil service jacket did say, "Do not rehire." I got a hold of that. I exposed that. He got fired. Crushed his life's dream. But I gave him the opportunity. I said, "Man, I'm sorry to have to do the story, but it is what it is." And he called me back a few days later and said, "Well, I'm not the only one." There are a lot of people in the academy class with me that have all these disqualifiers. Prior arrest in another state, bankruptcy, I think, was one of them. I said, "Absolutely. I will write anything that is supported by facts." So I wrote about several others who then also got thrown out of the academy. And it turned into, you know, kind of a minor scandal under the then new police chief, Richard Pennington. And here's a twist on that story about Rudy. He turned out to be a good source. He knew a lot of people. He knew a lot of cops. So not only did I flip him around and he became a great, you know, source and contact, and even a friend, he then went on to get a different job, completely different career, maybe a polar opposite career, as the manager of the Joe Bartholomew Golf Course, Pontchartrain Park. And turns out he was turned into an expert golfer, scratch golfer, and he said, "I come to work, I play around the golf first thing, then I set up and, you know, hang out at the golf course with all the great, you know, old timers of Pontchartrain Park." He said, "This is the best job I could possibly imagine. This is the dream job. Thank you."
Well,
and I would golf there from time to time, see Rudy, couldn't be happier, and actually thanked me.
Well, you never know how things are going to work out.
You never know.
You know, you really don't. Yeah, that's a good story as well. Well, some of the things that, are you ever amazed by some of this stuff? Because if you're like me, a consumer of the news, there'll be a story about, say, right now it is like the Orleans Justice Center story, okay? And like things come out, and it's like, you know, how does this happen? Or the Sewage and Water Board, which is a never-ending thing. They should have their own section in the paper, Sewage and Water Board. And I mean, really, are you ever amazed at how dysfunctional some of these things are? and corrupt?
You know, I mean, there's two ways to answer that. When it's New Orleans, where things just have a certain flair, even the corruption has a flair, even the crime has a flair.
Yeah.
You know, we can't just have a corrupt cop. We have to have Len Davis, who presided over a cocaine protection ring of 14 officers and then caught by the FBI in the process of the drug sting.
Right.
He is heard ordering the execution of a woman who filed a complaint against him and his partner, and a hitman carry out that murder. All caught on, you know, audio, FBI audio.
Yes.
So New Orleans is just different, and you have to suspend your disbelief a little bit, because anything can happen here, including, you know, you're on the razor's edge during hurricane season with the storm, and we saw the realization of that with Katrina, and obviously August 29th, 2005. So you're never like amazed, because if you're a journalist here, you know something that, you know, when you walk into that newsroom, it could be anything.
Sure. Well, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, but you're like, you and your colleagues are kind of my research department for the shows that I do, making fun of these people. Because I realized that when I was looking at your sewage waterboard thing, I got a great, you know, 15 or 20 minutes, or maybe even an hour about that, I guess, if I wanted to, about the sewage waterboard. And you and your colleagues are a source of my information.
Well, we did that hour-long documentary, you know, called Down the Drain. Usable information.
I mean, it's, well, for me it is, because it's like, you know, like LaToya would be gone, and it's like, I'll be the only one to be sorry to see her leave, okay, because I, you know, because she's such an easy target.
Oh, there'll be new people and scandals. Don't worry about that.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Now, but the flip side of never really amazed is you nevertheless appreciate that the news here is crazy. And I remember saying constantly, as well as my colleagues, we would never have the imagination to make this stuff up.
Right.
Like stuff that like actually happened. Let's just take Mayor Cantrell with an alleged affair with a police bodyguard boyfriend in the Pontalba apartment, kicked out, locks changed, and a federal indictment? No. I can guarantee you that's not happening in Des Moines, Iowa.
Probably not. Yeah, so I don't know whether that's good or bad, though. Okay, it's probably a little of both, I guess.
It keeps journalists in business around here, that's for sure.
You know, one of the things, we talked with Mike Perlstein, who's a crack, investigative reporter, the Pulitzer Prize winner, an Emmy winner, and Edward R. Murrow winner. And we really appreciate you taking his time. We've only got about 7 minutes left. It's gone pretty quickly. We could talk for a long time, I know, at least as far as I'm concerned. But one of the things that I wish that the investigators and reporters would do here would to do a deep dive into the judiciary and each judge. Because it seems like a clown show is giving it all the best.
An insult to clowns.
Yeah, that's right. It's an insult to clowns. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable, some of this stuff. You know,
it's kind of unbelievable, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's this woman. I did my comedy show last week, and one of the things I did was I did a wait, don't shoot me thing about the judiciary in Louisiana, and there's a judge in Baton Rouge that actually convicted a policeman in her court of a crime that does not exist. And then she also, after a jury in her courtroom found someone not guilty in a trial, she asked them to come into her chambers, and she talked to them, and she got them to go back outside and change the verdict. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the thing about judges, and I did cover, both New Orleans criminal court, federal court extensively, you know, forays into Jefferson Parish Court, and it's a tough nut to crack, because when there's, let's say, wrongdoing on the part of a judge, all of that gets handled by this Judiciary Commission,
right,
which operates in secret.
Right.
We don't have access to
like
their
skull and bones.
You know, and so that's changing a little bit. And I've presided over, I've done a bunch of stories that I think I got my good friend, rest in peace, Judge Charles Elwha, I got him removed from the bench. He kept doing those bond reductions. I told him, Judge, stop.
Yeah.
I wrote about dozens and dozens before Katrina, and he would get kind of like reprimanded and promised to stop.
Right.
He did slow down quite a bit. And then after Katrina, when the court reopened, he did one bond reduction of a guy named Brian Exposé. He's off the bench. Boom. So, yeah, occasionally it's out in the open where you can report on it. I will say that one of the stories I'm quite proud of, and it was non-sexy, and it was early on when I was at Channel 4, I got a good tip that these judges were purchasing supplemental insurance, supplemental health,
yeah,
and God only knows what else. Whole list of different supplemental insurance above and beyond what their, you know, position took care of. Just using funds from the, you know, judiciary account.
They have different funds, yeah.
And I exposed that and got all the documents. And it turns out, number one, wasn't just New Orleans Criminal Court, Civil Court, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal. And all of these judges got reprimanded, disciplined, hauled before the Judiciary Commission, and forced to pay back large sums of money that they had, you know, received benefits of this supplemental insurance, strictly illegal. And I can just say that I did lose some friends among the judges for exposing that, but
sure,
I got that policy changed. We exposed all of that, and a bunch of judges had to pay some money. So it's not like they're untouchable.
Well, no, I'm not saying y'all have never done anything, because obviously you have, and I appreciate that. But I'm just saying it just seems that there's so much of it that just seems out the box. And in the country that we live in now, I mean, we're kind of relying on the judiciary to be our last stopgap.
Right.
So it's kind of important.
And there's not like outside eyeballs. You know, like an administration, executive branch of a city, you get the inspector general, and the council keeps them in check. Who are the watchdogs of judges? Other judges,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
their bosses are the state Supreme Court. And
but that's
like
the problem.
They kind of take care of each other a little.
I mean, there was a recent thing where they were getting supplemental money, and one judge wanted to stop it because he thought it was unethical or whatever, and all the other judges said, oh, well, so he was outvoted. You know, and I mean, anyway, but we're almost out of time, Mike. I appreciate you so much. You stop. It's nice to see you as well. You think you're going to miss it? The missed the hunt, so to speak?
Well, I must say that it's refreshing, you know, to take a little break from, you know, headlines these days, you know, tend to be negative, sometimes downright depressing, certainly the national level, state level. You know, I miss the opportunity to help people. And, you know, eventually, as an investigative reporter, I gravitated to stories exposing injustice. And I will say the greatest pride, truly, beyond covering Katrina and, you know, all these other major stories that I did participate in, I got three people out of prison, two off of life sentences, just by showing the injustice, showing the unfairness. These are separate and apart from pure, like, exoneration, you know, innocence cases.
Right, right.
Which I covered quite a few of those as well.
Sure.
But much more difficult is just showing someone was dealt with unfairly. And
yeah.
Both, well, all three of those, one was at the newspaper, two were at Channel 4, several years of, you know, dogging the cases, writing updates, exposing the legal findings, and of ultimately the last two life sentences, prevailing on the district attorneys, Leon Canizero in Orleans, Warren Montgomery in St. Tammany, that this was in fact unfair. And they both sort of reluctantly agreed, and we got that corrected in court, and both of the guys I got out, Troy Ellis and more recently Jamal Cox, they're free. They're doing great. Huge, you know, productive citizens. Huge benefit to the community. And that, I, of course, keep in touch with them to this day. And that was really what I would describe as the most rewarding stories
right.
that I did.
I was about to say, that's very rewarding, I'm sure. Yeah.
especially to see them do well. It could have gone the other way.
That's true.
You hate to get a guy on to become this.
That happens sometimes.
A serial
sure.
killer, you know. But
right.
Fortunately, I bet on some good horses, and they did great. And I'm, you know, proud of the work and proud of them especially.
Well, good for you. Well, again, we're talking to Mike Pearlstein, the investigator reporter for WWL the last 15 years. Thomas Picayune before that, Pulitzer Prize winner, Emmy winner. We're out of time. I could talk to you for a couple of hours.
I'll tell you what, how about this? You and I are friends for a long time. I'll agree to do a part two and come back and do it again sometime.
All right, great. Thanks so much.
If Mike. You'll have me.
Absolutely.
So I didn't wear out the welcome.
No, I didn't even scratch the surface with us. Coming to things I wanted to ask you about the local things that are going on.
There's a lot going on. We can turn next time to maybe some of the more current events because,
okay.
you know, I still get the calls, the tips, and the line is overheated, to say the least. I'm sure you get an earful of material every day.
Well, thank you so much, Mike.
Absolutely, Chris. Thanks, man.
Great to see you.
All right.
Listen to Chewing the Yacht, WAMF 90.3 FM. We're on every Wednesday at 5 p.m. This is Chris Champagne saying bye-bye.